Hi, I'm Karen Vakaliuk. I am 53 years old. Today is Wednesday, July 28th, 2021. I am located in Harriman, Tennessee, which is near Knoxville. My recording partner is Michelle Scott Huffman, and I am a One Small Step partner with her.
And I am Michelle Scott Huffman. I am 49 years old. Today is Wednesday, July 28th, 2021, and I'm in Springfield, Missouri. My recording partner is Karen Vakaliuk, and we are One Small Step conversation partners.
So one question that I've been thinking of is, who would you say is your most influential teacher, either in a traditional setting like a school or a non-traditional setting? And why would you say that they influenced you that way?
That's a really powerful question for me, because I used to tell this story when I worked for the teachers union in Missouri about how deeply influential the public school teachers in general were for me. I grew up in a family that I'm not sure sometimes who was raising me, but we lived right across the street from the school. And I feel fairly certain that it was teachers who were raising me for the most part. But I think probably the most influential one would have been in high school. He was my history teacher. He was a horrible teacher, but he was also my basketball coach. And so he was deeply influential in my life, because he really taught me about commitment and responsibility and accountability and all those kind of things. And I feel like I might not have learned those things very well in the spaces that I was in otherwise. So he held that space for me when I left school world and spent a little bit of time in the military. I felt like he was former military. I felt like he had prepared me for that life as well. And So just as my life unfolded, I continued to see all the ways that he had influenced me over the years. So, yeah. How about you?
Did you, well, I was gonna say, did you keep in contact with them very long?
I did keep in contact with him for quite a while. He actually passed away just a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. And I was able to go to his memorial service and have really great conversation with his wife and his daughter and kind of reconnect with them. So, yeah.
That's nice.
He's a good guy.
That's really nice. I would say that there's definitely one in a traditional setting for me, and maybe one in kind of a non-traditional setting. Definitely in like the traditional setting, it was somebody in middle school. And I do think middle school teachers have to have such a, a dedication to teaching middle schoolers, because middle schoolers can be, I look back and I was so smarmy. I was just full of it, right? I can't even explain how bad I was, you know, but I had this one teacher, Mr. Coggin. And Mr. Coggin, it was around the time when, Saturday Night Live was doing this little thing about Mr. Bill. And it was like, oh no, Mr. Bill. And it was all this like funny little stuff, right? And so Mr. Coggin's first name was Phil. So we used to always tease him and say, oh no, Mr. Phil, you know? And I mean, he took it, no problem, but he taught us so much. He taught us, I just remember he would pick things out of like just common, you know, everyday culture, TV shows, different things. And he taught us English and social studies, because that's what they called it back then. And he taught us so much, and he shared so much of his life. He was in Vietnam. He was an English teacher in Vietnam in the war, just like that show, Good Morning Vietnam. You know, he taught English to people there, and he shared his life there with us and was very open about it. And we found that interesting, fascinating, you know, and I kept in touch with him for many years. He taught all the way through, and my kids had him when they were in middle school too. So I thought that was a very, you know, passing the torch kind of thing. And he always wanted to know what we were reading in high school, what we were reading in college. Are they keeping up? Are they keeping you educated? That kind of thing. So he also instilled in us an absolute love for science fiction. He, I mean, if he could throw everything else away, he would, and he would only focus on science fiction. We did short stories, we did books, and he just instilled in our class, especially, I think, a love for science fiction. And the classic science fiction, Isaac Asimov, that kind of thing, Ray Bradbury. He did also pass away, and I didn't know about it till afterwards, but I did send his wife a long letter saying how much that he influenced, I think, our whole class, but me especially. I'd say in the non-traditional setting, I have a really good friend named Betsy, and I swear every time I meet with her, like I learn something new from her. And we have a lot of things in common. We've done, you know, Girl Scouts, we've done sewing, we've done all different things, theater. And so there's always something new that I can learn from her. And I think that I definitely see her in that sense. So.
That's awesome. So I saw in your bio that you are a mother of three grown children, and I'm a mother of just recent adults, so 18 and 21 years old. And I'm always looking toward people who have survived longer than me for hope that I'll keep surviving and so will they. And will you tell me about your children and what are they like?
So although my husband would say, yes, they are technically adults, that they really haven't reached really adulting yet, as they say it. But I have she's 25, and she is probably always lost. She's always one of those kids who you have to like, okay, let's redirect you here. Okay, we're going this way, you know. She graduated with an associate's and then started doing childcare work. And, you know, she never would have thought that somebody would ever call her essential until a pandemic hit and she was essential. She kind of struggled through the pandemic with her coworkers. A lot of her coworkers left and took unemployment, and she did not. And because of that, she was kind of given a bonus. She was given 3 weeks extra pay for that year, and she was given 3 weeks extra vacation. So, you know, we commended her for sticking to it. She has now decided to become a massage therapist. So she's going to stop that, and she starts her certificate program for massage therapy. She really likes people, and she really feels that it would be good to work in that field. So that's our oldest. Her name is Anna, as she always says, as in Princess Anna. And then our second one is Gabriel, who is a very good description of him. He's a really smart kid. I'm not a mom who brags all the time, but he's pretty smart. One of his chemistry teachers said, you know, your son, he's gonna rule the world, or he's gonna be in jail for trying to rule the world. I said, okay, good to know. I hope it's the first. he's working for a company that does work in the healthcare industry, and he's doing all of the programming and tech for it. And he's working remotely right now. He could work from anywhere, and he's living in the southern part of Tennessee and working remotely. His company is in California, but they found, you know, to really appeal to these young people, remote work is a good thing. And our youngest is starting college in September at Savannah College of Art and Design in vocal performance. So she's flying the coop. But although she, in her mind, she's already flown, so. But yeah, it's good to see. It's funny. My son said at Christmas, he goes, wow, it's really interesting. We're getting gifts for you now. I'm like, I know, you guys make money. You can buy me a gift now. So that was actually kind of funny. So, yeah.
That's funny. I last year I bought a pair of Vans tennis shoes with a gift card that my daughter had given me, and it felt like this fun, like, reversal of roles that was
right
that I had never expected.
Right. So you have two. I can't remember. You said you had a couple of kids.
I do. I have two. Alexis is our oldest, and she is 21. She's a junior at Drury University, which is here in Springfield. It's a school that's affiliated with the Christian Church Disciples of Christ and the United Church of Christ, although they would very adamantly point out that that's a historic affiliation. But she wanted to go to a small private school, and because I'm ordained in the Disciples of Christ, she gets a significant discount there. And so I said, if you turn private down. School, here's your option. And so she looked at several disciple schools and chose that one. She actually chose it before we lived in Springfield. So we lived a couple hours away. And then I was offered a campus ministry position that brought me here too. And we checked in pretty heavily about that, if she was okay with that. And she said she was. So so we followed her to Springfield, actually the summer before she started school. So she's majoring in criminology and political science with a minor in Spanish, and she'll be starting her senior year this fall. But she just woke up like 2 months ago and said, I think I want to be a nurse.
Okay.
And so there's not a lot in her current programs that translates into a nursing program. So in her final year, she's going to take anatomy and physiology so that she has those under her belt and can just jump into a nursing program. Okay. So that's her story. And then our youngest is 18, and she's about to start college also. She's going to Pittsburgh State in Kansas, which is just about an hour and a half from us. And she's a homebody, so she'll we'll see how that goes. We haven't told Missouri State, which is the state school here in Springfield, that she's not coming, just in case like she gets there and is like, no, I'm not doing it.
Stringing them along still.
Yeah. Yeah. So we'll move.
Was it hard for her to decide what to do? Was it a hard year? Cause I thought it was a hard year for my daughter as a senior year. And the applications to colleges was, I think it was harder. You know, everybody said, oh, we're not going to look at test scores. But I mean, if you send the test scores, they're going to look at them probably. Just saying, you know.
Yeah, it was a little tricky. And she wasn't looking at too many places. We were kind of looking mostly in like a geographic circle of like what's an hour and a half to 2 hours. And, you know, we have a program in Missouri called A+, where if they do, they keep their attendance at a certain thing, and they have a pretty minimal, like, minimum GPA and do a number of service hours, that they can do 2 hours or 2 years of community college. So basically an associate's degree for free. And so we have the school here. Yeah. And so it was hard for her to make that decision, because she's always been kind of fairly kind of frugal and worried about, you know, whether mom can afford something or not. So
yeah it's been crazy, you know. Like, my daughter had all these ideas, and actually when she applied to SCAD, so, you know, that where she's going, that was her backup school, and she really thought she would get into my husband's and my alma mater, which she did not. And I think it was very disappointing for her. But I also, you know, I told her it's a crazy year. You know, there's going to be a lot more people applying to different colleges. And it was hard. It's hard to see the disappointment in her. But I do think that she's finally accepted, you know, the choice she's made. So, and she's eager to go. So.
And what's yours and your husband's alma mater?
We both went to Northwestern, which is in Illinois. So, yeah. And I was okay with her if she would go there, but I wanted it to, I also wanted her college to be her own experience and not to like us to live nostalgically through her kind of thing, you know? She really did love the campus. It's a beautiful campus. But it's a different college than when we went there, you know? So.
Yeah. It's funny you say that. My daughter, it's funny what younger children's kind of perceptions of what they should do.
Oh yeah.
How those form over time. So my, ex-husband, the father of my children, has two children that are older than them. So they have a brother and sister, and their oldest sister had gone to TCU in Fort Worth, Texas Christian University.
Yeah.
And that's one of the schools that Alexis looked at. And Morgan was real quiet through the whole process. But after she ended up at Drury, Morgan said, "Oh my goodness, I'm so glad she didn't go to TCU, because then I would have had to go there." Because her two older sisters had gone there.
Right. Just a little pressure, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I know.
So,
I know.
It's funny.
A friend of mine from college said, "Aren't you glad we went to college back when it was cheap?" I'm like, "Well, still wasn't cheap back then, but still, yeah, I know it's astronomical now." So,
yes, big difference now for sure.
Mm.
For sure. So, how did you become a doula? What was that path?
Okay, so before I was a doula, I was a bunch of different things. I was a medical not a medical transcriber, a medical biller. So I billed for medical offices for many years, almost 25 years. And I was also a costume designer for 15 years in there. And I really wanted to retire from both of those for different reasons. And I had read a book. I highly recommend it to anybody. It is an amazing book. It's called The Power of Lift. And it's by Melinda Gates, who is soon to probably drop that name at some point. But it is called The Power of Lift. And it talks about, you know, when a rocket lifts up and it reaches that point where it can get out of the area of the Earth and get into space, that's the power of lift she was talking about. So she basically says, when you empower women, you empower communities, and that can empower the world. And so she takes, it really is an amazing book. I really loved it. It's simple, but I think it's great. So she takes in each chapter, she takes an issue that we have in our world and that we have in our communities too, not just our world, that how can women and how are women making changes in this? And one of the very first chapters was about birth. And birth can be an amazing thing, but it can also be a very scary and a very hard thing to go through. And I said to myself, well, I had three amazing births, all with midwives. I felt very empowered. I had a doula at two of them. I said, I could make a difference in women's lives and in families' lives if I become a doula. So I literally put down the book and I started doing my work towards certification to become a doula. And then I told my husband, "Oh, by the way, I'm changing my job and I'm becoming a doula." He's like, "Great, yay!" So I've had seven births now. And I even if I only have those births, I say it has been worth it. I feel like I've helped women empower their birth and do what they've wanted to do with their own story. You know, I don't want somebody else to write their story. I don't want somebody else to make their decisions. I want them to be able to feel that they're doing it. So I love it.
That's great. And what does your husband do?
He's a computer programmer right now, I should say. There's a national lab very near where we live. So there are many in the country, but the one here in Tennessee was the one that was instrumental in creating the enriched uranium for the first atomic bomb. I mean, it's something to be famous for, I guess. But he right now works with drones, and he works with drone technology at the lab. But he starts a new job at the same lab in October, where he's going to be a manager for the spallation neutron source. And if you don't understand what that is, just nod and smile, because that's what I do. I just go, "Yeah, right." So yeah, he's he and then in his in his spare time, he likes to do radio astronomy. So if you've ever seen the movie Contact, where those big dishes and they like point to space and they're listening for aliens, that's what he likes to do in his part-time spare time. So yeah, he's a bit of a geek, but that's okay.
Nice.
And so what brought you into becoming a pastor?
Well, I guess the short answer is God, which a part of my ministry is with the Unitarian Universalist Church. So that answer doesn't work for them. it does in some places, but not in the particular one that I serve. So, I grew up in a family that was not at all religious. So, as to demonstrate that point, like all of our family reunions happen at 11:30 on Sunday morning. And then when I get there an hour and a half late, they're always like, where were you?
My church.
And they're like, well, we were going to have you pray, but you weren't here. No, because I was there praying. But I grew up in this family that wasn't religious at all. And like I said, I'm the youngest of five kids, and they're all enough older than me that they were kind of doing their own thing. And I feel like as a kid, I was probably looking for connection and just spaces that felt really structured and good in that way. And so I think probably when I was like 7 years old, I was walking to church by myself. We lived in a really small town, and, you know, it was 1970 something. So those things seem safe. And so I would walk to this church, and I went there for several years. And then we had some neighbors move in that went to a church that was a little further away, and I started going with them. And there was just something that kept sort of drawing me back to church. When I was ordained and I was preparing to serve communion at my ordination, I was remembering that as a child, I would play communion with my friends. And I grew up in a Baptist church, so we didn't do communion very often. And so I have to wonder like what those pieces were that were really kind of pulling me. So I was in my late 20s at the church that I grew up at, helping with the youth program, you know, taking them to amusement parks and doing those kinds of things with them, and just really sensed that there was a vocation there that was kind of calling me to something that I couldn't really understand. And so that was a very long process, right? I'm a woman in the Southern Baptist Church, and I go to my pastor and say, so I'm pretty sure I'm called to ministry. And he thought that was pretty funny. And he said, God doesn't call women to ministry. And so the incredible thing about it was, though, that like that church had prepared me for that very moment. Like we had done this really intense Bible study a couple of years before that, where they were essentially like, you're going to come to a point where you have this kind of fundamental crisis of belief, and all of the embedded ideas and belief systems that you've relied on up to that point all of a sudden won't work, and you have to like shut out all the other voices and wrestle it out with God. And so I did. And so I just said, okay, so this is a thing that I'm being called to, and that means I have to leave this place. And so I went from there into the Assemblies of God, because I knew that they ordained women and had for a long time. And that felt like a place where I could do what I was being called to. I spent about 5 years there. And in that process, I was halfway through my seminary, my master's degree, when I came to the realization that I was also gay. And
were you married at the time?
I was.
Okay.
Yeah. And my husband and I were both in a ministry kind of training path. We were both in that seminary. When we split up, he abandoned it pretty quickly. I think it was kind of a thing that just we were doing together, and individually that didn't really make sense to him. And I also sort of tried to abandon it, because I was like, I struggled through this period, right? Like, there's things that I didn't know about myself that I kind of need to figure out. And so there was about a year period of my life where I was doing a lot of that figuring out, and came to the end of it and understood this to be sort of integrally and fundamentally who I was as a person, and that I couldn't do ministry outside of that kind of authenticity and understanding of my full self. And so I tried to just walk away. So in God terms, I would say like, sorry, there's a fly. I would say that God doesn't let you just walk away or you know, your calling or the universe or whatever it is. Like if you're called to a thing, you don't just get to walk away, at least not very comfortably. And so I, you know, found an Eden Seminary in St. Louis, which is an open and affirming seminary, and just started to discover this whole world of experience of religion and church and Christianity that I had never even known existed. And so it was a little bit like walking into my skin. So
did you have to do all of your seminary training over again or just part of it?
I did. I took my transcript. I was all proud of it. So the seminary that I was in, Regent University School of Divinity, which is Pat Robertson's school.
Oh, yeah.
So I went to Eden Seminary with my little transcript and I was like, these are my classes that I've taken. And they laughed at me again and said, we'll call those electives. And I successfully argued that pastoral care was pastoral care and they should give me equivalent credit for it, which is actually not true at all. The way that I learned pastoral care in one place was very different than pastoral care in the other place. But I successfully got those 3 hours transferred over, but the rest were all elective credits. And so I did the full program all over again. And I'm glad I did.
Did you find at the new seminary that the classes, what did you find different about them? Was it different approaches, different, what?
Yeah. So everything was different, but fundamentally the kind of lens with which you do the, particularly in biblical studies, at Eden Seminary, you're not coming at the text as this kind of monolithic, you know, like God wrote it through the hand of a human, literal interpretation kind of thing. There's much more learning about historical critical context and all of these kinds of different understandings of the text. And so it's definitely like just a fundamental shift in the way that you understand the biblical text, and also church history like is taught in a very different way. Honestly, it was through that experience of having so two required church history classes in one place and then two required church history classes in another place that I fell in love with church history and became such a church geek that I'm just sort of obsessed with the systems and the structures and the institutions and the ways that we flawed humans keep messing them up, but somehow there's something that keeps it moving along. And
when you say church history, do you mean church history from a Protestant perspective or church history from Jesus?
From the very beginning, from Jesus through the early church, through the, you know, what we would call now the Roman Catholic Church, but for, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years was just the church, and then the Protestant Reformation and kind of all of that. So that was kind of the path. Is there a religious or spiritual path that you've been on?
So I pretty much grew up Catholic, and I'd say I walked away from it in high school for a while. I did not get confirmed. And my mother said, fine, whatever. I'm sure you'll get confirmed someday. And then in high school, I was actually hired by another church to sing because I had a pretty good singing voice. So I was going to a congregational church in high school just because they paid me. So, and it was very different because obviously it's not the same liturgy. It's very different liturgically, so I had to get used to that. And then in college, I think this is what happened in college, is there were so many people. I went to a Midwestern college surrounded by, I'd say, a lot of Lutherans and Presbyterians. And I think that the only thing that I felt safe with was being Catholic again, because that's the thing I knew. So I was like, well, I'm going to be Catholic. And then everybody would say, oh, you know, don't be Catholic. I mean, that's going to ruin your faith, you know, and stuff. They'd say stuff like that. And I'd be like, well, that made me want to cling on to it even more to prove to them that I could be Catholic and, you know, and everything. So I got confirmed in college, and my husband and I met in a Christian group in college. It's called InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if you know that. So we met through that. He has a very interesting story. And I mean, he could tell it to you and it would take 3 hours, but he had this crazy experience between his freshman and sophomore year in college, where he was a little bit of a recreational drug user. Let's just say that. Anyway, he had this experience or trip in which he felt that Mother Mary was calling to him, and he had all these different experiences. And he said he came out of that feeling that A, he should become Christian, and B, hell would mean he'd have to pick up all his cigarette butts, and see that Mary was calling him to something, right? So he went to college that year, and he was at the airport, and there was this Salvation Army table with giving out tracts, and one of them said, give up your way, give up your bad ways and turn over to God. And he goes, okay, just like that. And so he went to college, and then he joined this InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. We met, and a friend of his, you know, on the same floor gave him a Bible, which he read in one weekend. Just going to say that. So speed reading there. But, you know, and then when we met, he wasn't anything. In fact, before he read the Bible, the only thing he knew about Jesus was that he walked on water and that he was tempted by the devil. He knew nothing else about Jesus, nothing. And so he ended up becoming Catholic as well. And it's so funny, because when people find out that he wasn't anything before and that he had this whole past before, they're like, but you're so Catholic. I can't believe it. You know? But we recently moved, and so we changed churches. So that's been a big change in our lives. But yet it's the same liturgy. We feel it's a very comfort thing. You know, it's one thing that you can say. I mean, I could go to a Catholic church and Spain, I might not understand it, but it's the same liturgy, so it's a very comforting kind of thing. He really likes the new pastor at the church we're at, because before he became a priest, he was a computer programmer, so they can talk shop. Mm-hmm. But yeah,
that's really awesome. I someday I hope to write books, and the fly is hitting my head. I hope to write books. And a few years ago, I was driving back from it was the Festival of Homiletics in Atlanta. And so I'd been in this space for like 4 days with all this preaching and talking about preaching and all these church people. And I was driving home, and I was listening to a book by Richard Rohr. I can't remember what it was called, but it was the one that talks a lot about Francis, Saint Francis. And then I became like obsessed with Pope Francis for a while. And so I've decided that one of the books that I'm going to write someday is going to be called Pope Crush, with the subtitle,
oh, I love it.
how the mainline Protestant church fell in love with the leader of the Roman Catholic Church and why that's a good thing. So that
I love it. I absolutely love it. I'll admit, I've always wanted to write a book too. And it's based on, there's one line in the church, in the liturgy, in the service, that says, Lord, I am not worthy to receive you, but only say the word and my soul shall be healed. So I've always wanted to, it's my favorite prayer in the whole liturgy, right? But I wanted to write the book called Lord, I Am Not Worthy. And I think, well, I have a title at least. So I don't have anything else, but
Yeah, that's great. I love that. I also believe that the Roman Catholic Church has the greatest like social teaching that there is, and so I greatly appreciate that. And it's funny how, so I grew up, like I said, Baptist, and there's this real, particularly in like mid Missouri, this real kind of anti-Catholic sentiment. So the strangest thing is like being a kid and having like some Catholic friends in school and hearing that the preacher, we didn't even call him pastor. He really was preacher. That's what he did. And then pastoral care is a whole other thing. But to hear them like even suggest that your Catholic friends are like going to hell, right? Like that's even a thing, that it seems so bizarre to me right now that I can't even fathom it. But I was preaching one time in a church, and in the service I was talking about how our how communion as we know it today, you know, developed through the years, you know, certainly in the Roman Catholic Church, and that we adopted some of those practices and kind of let go of some, you know, the whole like transubstantiation thing and all that. Like there are conversations around that. But in the same sermon, I spoke about and quoted the Dalai Lama. And after the service, a woman came up to me, and I think she literally called me the Antichrist. And it was because I had talked about a connection with the Roman Catholic Church. And I was like, did you hear me quote the Dalai Lama? Like, I feel like you should be more concerned about that if you are concerned about something.
She heard what she wanted to hear.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I live in Tennessee, and Tennessee is probably, I think, 49th out of the 50 states in the percentage of Catholics here. It's a small amount, you know. I can go down like the road, country roads around here, and there are probably 20 Baptist churches within 5 minutes of me, 20 or something like that. You know, and there's a lot of primitive Baptist churches around here too. So I can find a lot of Baptist churches, but I have to go half an hour to find a Catholic church.
So I'm wondering how that your Catholic identity, how do you connect that with like the state of the world right now? And what do you feel like it kind of calls you to out of that identity?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, definitely you're right. The social teachings are important, and seeing everybody as a child of God is a very important thing. And I think that it would be hard to, I don't know. You definitely need to look at people in a different lens. And I don't know if that's my Catholic teaching, but I suppose it is. But looking at each other, and as the basic thing, we are all children of God. We are all called to personal holiness. We are all called to do what we can for our brothers and sisters. And our brothers and sisters are not just the ones that were the same, who have the same father and mother as us. You know, our brothers and sisters in need are our brothers and sisters in Christ, whether we get along with them or not, whether we, you know, feel the same way about things or not. We are called to reach out to them and to serve them, you know. And I think that the pandemic, I mean, I think has brought this awareness to more people. When the pandemic started, I was in the middle of certifying to be a doula, which was kind of hard because, you know, things were closing down and hospitals were closing down. And I pivoted with a lot of other people and made face masks. So I made a ton of face masks, and it's definitely, the number is over 4,000, but I don't know the exact number. Wow. So, and that was one, I always tell people, you know, it was one small thing that I could do every day, focus, get the job done, and mail them out to people, you know, and then some people are like, but you don't know who they're going to. I don't care who they're going to. They're going to somebody who will use it and maybe save their lives, right?
Yeah. Thank you for that. I'm in the epicenter of the Delta variant right now in Southwest Missouri. And I'm so thankful for all the people who, at the very beginning, we had a big interfaith effort here of people making masks who were Jewish and Muslim and Christian and, you know, atheist and UU. And it was just a really beautiful effort. And I was amazed by the way that people could just hit the ground running with something that was so practical and so meaningful at the same time.
So yeah. I met a lot of people doing it, you know, and at first I met some adversity from people saying, why are you wasting your time? Nobody's going to end up wearing a mask. I'm like, well, you know what? We'll see about that. And I still wear my mask almost everywhere, even though I'm fully vaccinated. I still strongly believe in the masks. So.
Awesome. Yeah. So thank you for making masks. Thank you for taking the time to share. When people share their kind of their journey to where they are and in their faith and in their vocation and their life, I just feel sort of deeply blessed to be honored to carry that story with them. So thank you for sharing your story with me.
And thank you also for sharing yours with me and getting to know a little bit about you and your family. And I wish you all the best in the near future. And you'll be an empty nester soon. So don't try to organize the rooms right away.
Good advice. Thanks.